Lecture 44, The Middle Ptolemies, The Decline.
Hello again. Remember last time we started the Ptolemaic dynasty? And we were talking about the good Ptolemies, Ptolemies 1 and 2. They built the library at Alexandria and the lighthouse. And they're starting to run Egypt like a business, but it's doing well. They have the priests supported because that's their kind of bureaucracy that's going to do the trading for them. Well, we've got one more good Ptolemy, right? What I call the good Ptolemy, Ptolemy 3. And after that, we're going to see what in modern terms would be called a dysfunctional family. They murder each other. You know, they're constantly poisoning, stabbing, scalding, butchering each other, literally. And we'll see Egypt slip down and down and down into the mud until it's at the point where when a great Ptolemy comes along, Egypt almost can't be saved. But let's start, like my mother always said, emphasize the good. Let's start with Ptolemy III, the good Ptolemy. He does quite a few nice things. One is he builds an Egyptian temple at Edfu. Now, Edfu is in the south of Egypt. It's a southern temple. It's large. It is one of the best preserved temples in all of Egypt. It is huge. Now, let's think about what Ptolemy III is doing in building Edfu Temple, right? One thing is he's getting along with the Egyptian priests. You know, they like to build temples. They know about rituals. And if you build a temple, in a sense, you're creating a bureaucracy. You're going to need more priests to staff it and so on. So the priests are probably happy about this. There's no question about that. The temple is dedicated to one of the traditional gods, Horus, right? The main god. Remember, the pharaoh has always been identified with Horus. So in a sense, maybe they convince him, they tell him that, look, this is a temple to you, really. It's Horus, you're the falcon on earth, whatever. But he builds this big temple. It's well-preserved. Almost all of the very well-preserved temples in Egypt are built by the Ptolemies. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, they're the most recent, of course, of the Egyptian temples. So they've had fewer years to be pulled down, blocks to be reused. So that's one. They're the newcomers to the Egyptian temples. But the other is, after the Ptolemies died out, these things fell into disrepair. There were no longer priests who were supported. So people actually built their houses on top of the temples. The temples became sort of filled in, and they were preserved by this. So the best temples in Egypt are Ptolemaic ones. But it's dedicated to Horus. Now, on the walls of this temple is the oldest drama in the world. It's a play. And it's sort of what we would call a mystery play. In ancient Egyptian times, not Ptolemaic times, but the times of the pharaohs, the very early times of the pharaohs, perhaps just after Narmer, undoubtedly the king was the high priest. He was the whole show. And there were myths, of course. We talked about them, the myth of Isis and Osiris. And this pharaoh, high priest, would go throughout Egypt and would have to enact rituals, various ceremonies. And one of them was the triumph of Horus over Seth. Now remember, Seth, also called Set, is the evil brother who has killed Osiris, and Horus is the avenger, right? Well, in one of the myths, it's called the contending of Horus and Seth, right? They're battling each other, they're contentious. In this myth, Osiris is already dead, but Horus, the son of the god, wants his rightful inheritance, right? He's the son of Osiris, who is, in a sense, the pharaoh of Egypt. He wants his rightful inheritance, the world. He wants to rule over Egypt. Now, evil Seth says, no, 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 I'm the stronger. Now, it's an interesting conflict. It's between the rightful heir and the stronger. Right? That's the claim. And the gods are not sure how to settle this. It's kind of a litigious thing. The gods are not sure how to settle it. Well, he's stronger. Maybe he should rule. Well, he's the son. Maybe he should rule. And for 80 years, they're battling it out, trying to... And in this myth, all kinds of things happen. For example, Seth, by magic, is turned into a hippopotamus. He's often shown as a hippopotamus. Now, Horus is about to do him in. He's going to harpoon him. But Seth, clever, remember, he's this devil figure. He's always going to be there. He's sort of existential evil. You know, it's like in the fortune cookies, when you get that, you know, little fortune that says, say what you will about the devil, he's a hustler. You know, that's Seth, right? He's about to be harpooned. Horus is going to do him in, and he cries out to Isis, sister, save me, right? This is kind of, and remember, Isis is this nurturing goddess. So she can't let her brother die. She saves him. Right? He should have been killed, but she saves him. Right? And Horus is so angered by this that he, in anger, cuts off his mother's head, cuts off Isis's head. Now, it's a very long myth, which I'm not going to go into in any more detail, but the point is you have these contendings, and the good news is Isis's head is restored. That's okay. But what happens, right, is we get this battle, and in the end, only in the end, after the great battle, is Horus given Egypt to rule. Set, by the way, is given something. It's kind of, it's not just, oh, he's a creep, banish him. No, he's given the desert. Right? Remember, the Egyptians never liked the desert. That was a place where who knows what lived. So Seth is given the desert. Horus is given earth. And goodness triumphs over evil. Now, this is on the walls of Edfu Temple built by Ptolemy III. In ancient days, when I say ancient, again, back to the time of Narmer, the earliest dynasties, the pharaoh would have gone up and down Egypt and enacted the contendings of Horus and Seth, with Pharaoh playing the part of Horus, defeating Seth, and that means Ma'at, divine order, will rule. Right? And each year the Pharaoh would have to do this to make sure that there'd be divine order for the following year. So on the walls of Edfu Temple is this ritual that the Pharaoh would have gone through. And if you read the walls of Edfu Temple, and when I say read it, you don't need the hieroglyphs for this one. There are pictures. You'll see Horus on a little papyrus skiff, a little boat, harpooning, you know, set as a hippo beneath it. So Ptolemy III is putting very traditional stuff on the walls of his temple. Undoubtedly, his priests are advising him, right? So this is one good thing that our last good Ptolemy does. He does Edfu Temple. And on the walls also is another ritual which was enacted for thousands of years before him and was enacted for the next few hundred years. Whenever a temple was built, a ceremony called the stretching of the cord had to be performed. Now this was, in a sense, it's the laying of the foundation stone, and it's not unlike what even modern masons do today when they're doing a foundation. You have these cords stretched out, you know, so you know it's true, it's squared. And on the walls, it shows this ceremony for this very temple. And it's got the goddess Seshat. She is the goddess of writing in the sense of measurements. She's kind of an engineer. And she records exactly the measurements of the temple. And they did the stretching of the cord when the pharaoh would come. And this is on Edfu Temple. So there's a reaching back to the old history of Egypt, but certainly it's the priests who are telling them what to do. By the way, and we're going to see this in just a few minutes, whenever a temple was built, foundation deposits were laid at the four corners. It was a tradition that goes way back. At the four corners of the temple, once you figure out the dimensions of the temple, you've done your stretching of the cord, at the four corners, you dug a pit. And in that pit, you put clean sand, clean white sand. And in that pit that's now been lined with pure sand, you put little magical objects that would ensure that the temple would be constructed well. So, for example, in foundation deposits, you get little tiny brick molds, like the brick we made the bricks with, little tiny ones. You'll sometimes get tools, little miniature tools, and perhaps some inscriptions, a prayer for the temple or whatever, with the name of the pharaoh who's building the temple. So almost always at four corners of temples are foundation deposits. Still today, by the way, in Egypt, there are plenty of those deposits waiting to be discovered. In the 19th century, foundation deposits weren't really known. They didn't know that they had a lot of these foundation deposits. So people weren't looking for them. So a lot of the earlier places that have been excavated, there are still foundation deposits to be found. Also, sometimes you find them in curious places, but there's an explanation. For example, some temples have 6 foundation deposits. Yeah. Why? Well, they started to build a temple. Let's say it was going to be a square. You build your 4, you dig your little 4 pits, and you have your foundation deposits. But now, as it's building, you decide, well, let's make it bigger. So you expand it now, making it a rectangle perhaps, but you've got another 2 new corners. So you dig another 2 foundation deposits. So sometimes temple has 6. So you have to be sort of vigilant. When you're excavating a temple, you have to see, was it enlarged? And then you know what to look for. But at Edfu Temple, undoubtedly, you had these foundation deposits. And it even shows the pharaoh present, putting some objects, 17 little bricks, into a... Remember, 17 was a magical number. And Edfu tells the whole story. So if you look at these temples, you'll get the story of what's going on. But this is Ptolemy III's temple at Edfu. He also, we have a few records of him, what he did during his reign. One is called the Decree of Canopus. Canopus was a part of Egypt in the Delta. And this is really a stela. Remember our big round-top stones that anybody wanted to make an announcement he carved. And the Decree of the Canopus, we have 3 versions of it. Now, let me say why it's so important. Not just because it tells about Ptolemy, no. It was just like the Rosetta Stone. It was written in 3 scripts, 2 languages, if you'll remember. Egyptian is one language, and Greek is the other. And this was written in hieroglyphs, right, which is Egyptian, hieroglyphic script, Demotic, which is Egyptian, more cursive script, and Greek. Right, so if the Rosetta Stone hadn't been found, we would have had this, which might have helped us. But it wasn't discovered until much later, 1881. We have a copy of it. But we have 3 different versions. This was important. We had 3 versions of it. Big stone, carved, right? It must have been placed at various temples for everybody to see. What does it tell us? It tells us basically that Ptolemy III was a good administrator, a good person. One thing it says, the Nile didn't rise during one of the years. Now, what that means is famine, because you can't grow crops without water. And if the Nile didn't overflow its banks, the irrigation canals, even if you've dug them, are going to be empty. Ptolemy bought grain at a high price to feed the people, right? So he's viewed as a beneficent king. He's okay. It also says that Ptolemy recaptured the statues of the Egyptian gods that were taken away when the Persians invaded. Now, and that he brought them back and placed them in the temples again. This, of course, would have pleased the priests greatly. Now, the great thing about the ancient world was when you're interested in polytheism, when you believe in many gods, you know, you've got a lot of options. The Persians come in, conquer the Egyptians, and what do? They take back their gods. Maybe they're powerful. So they're stealing their gods, and they kept them because Ptolemy III finds them and brings them back. Kind of nice. And as a result of his good deeds, the priests erect this stela and say, Ptolemy is a wonderful person, and we're going to do something. Ptolemy had a daughter. Her name is Bernice. She died young, right? And what they say, what the priests say on this decree, is they are going to worship her. They're going to make offerings to her. It's the same as lighting a candle for her. And it's a very interesting way they refer to her. They call her Bernice, Lady of Virgins. Lady of Virgins. It's almost, you know, the Virgin Mary. We're getting things out of Egyptian religion that are going to come to our lives. Let me read a little section of the Decree of Canopus, just so you get a feeling for the language and how it sounds and what the priests say. And this is what the priests declare, written on this decree in 3 scripts, so the Greeks can read it, and so the Egyptians can read it. Ptolemy III and Berenike are continually performing many great benefits to the national temples, right? And take good care of the Apis and Menevis bulls. Now, the Apis, I've mentioned a few times. Next time, we're going to talk about him in detail. It's a fascinating subject, the Apis. But he was a sacred bull, and Ptolemy III is taking good care of him. That means he's alive, the bull, and he's in a temple, and he's being fed and well cared for. The Menephis was another sacred bull from Heliopolis. We know hardly anything about him. But they're taking care of these bulls. And it says, taking care of the Apis and Menephis bulls and other renowned sacred animals. Animals were important to these Ptolemies, you'll see. And the sacred images carried off from the land by the Persians. The king, having made a foreign campaign, recovered into Egypt and restored to the temples from which each of them had been carried away. Right? So he's doing quite a lot for the Egyptians, both in economy and religion. Now, there's another monument of Ptolemy III that's really perhaps his most important. Remember last time I said that the Library of Alexandria, built by Ptolemy I, completed by Ptolemy II, disappeared. We have no traces. We really don't. There is, by the way, a library being built today in Alexandria on what they say is near the site of the original one. It's going to be a huge library, and they're hoping to fill it with all the books of the world. It's a wonderful project that the Egyptians are undertaking, and they're hoping to get world support also, and they probably will. But the library has disappeared. But there was supposedly a sister library, right? Sometimes called the daughter library. And this may be what is called today the Serapeum of Alexandria. There were two Serapia, right? Two Serapiums. One was where the Apis bull was buried at Saqqara. That's the one we've talked about. But there's another that I haven't mentioned yet, and that's what we have to talk about now. The Serapeum of Alexandria. This is constructed by Ptolemy III, our last good Ptolemy. It is dedicated not to the bull, the Apis bull, no. It is dedicated to a Greek-created god. They manufactured this god, Serapis. It's a combination of the two gods, Apis. Apis was actually an ancient Egyptian called Ap. And the Greeks had the ending, so it's an Apis. And Osir was Osiris. Osir. So Osirapis becomes Serapis. Now, they manufactured them. Why? You've got 300,000 Greeks living in Alexandria. And these gods of the Egyptians look pretty weird. Body of a man, head of an ibis, you know, a woman with the head of a lioness. They look strange. And the Ptolemies are smart people. They want to come up with a god that the Greeks can relate to. So they manufacture one, Serapis. He looks like Zeus, right? He's got a beard, big, long beard, very un-Egyptian for a god, right? On his head, he's got a basket, which contains produce, right? This is a god who kind of is the bountiful god, making sure that the land of Egypt will produce plenty. Interestingly, by the way, there is a slight Egyptian holdover here, I believe. In ancient Egypt, fertility gods were male. And in a sense, Serapis is a little bit of a fertility god, guaranteeing produce. For example, the major fertility god of ancient Egypt was Min, who is shown as a man with an erect phallus, showing that he's, you know, he will produce. So we have a kind of Egyptianized, very Greek version of a Min here. Now, the temple of Serapis is dedicated to this god. But there is an important connection with the library. It is believed that this temple served a dual function. First, it's to worship the god Serapis. There were shrines where offerings could be made. But also, the architecture of it suggests that this may have housed papyri. This may be the famous daughter or sister library of the big one. The reason we think that is there were two fireplaces inside this temple, and throughout the building, going to various chambers, are pipes, which would bring hot air to the rooms. So it's kind of very early central heating. And many people think that the purpose of bringing hot air to these rooms is to preserve papyri in the moist Alexandria air. You've got to keep it dry or it'll rot. So this may indeed have been what we would call today the annex of the great library. Now, there's another interesting sort of coda to this story of the Serapeum. Books were so important to the Ptolemies, so important, that when a ship came into the port of Alexandria, it was searched for books. And if it had books, they were taken off, they were confiscated, copied by scribes in the library, and then the copies were returned. Right? Ptolemies kept the originals, but they wanted everything. Now, the only library that even approached the Alexandria Great Library was at Pergamum in Asia Minor. And the competition was so fierce between the Alexandrian Library and the Pergamum Library that Egypt, the Ptolemies, stopped exporting papyrus because they didn't want the library at Pergamum to be able to copy all these books. They stopped exporting it. And you know a result of that sort of embargo on papyrus? The modern book. We have books today because the Ptolemies refused to export papyrus. What happened was, well, the Pergamum Library couldn't get any papyrus, so what are they going to do? They're going to use vellum, sheepskin. But sheepskin doesn't roll nicely like papyri. You can't attach them and make a huge papyrus and roll it up. They stack better than they roll. And then when they started sewing leaves together, you got a book. So the first books are the result, really, of the Ptolemies sort of being greedy about their library. Now, this Serapeum, this place of Serapis, but also a library, had foundation deposits. They were discovered during World War II. There was an excavator. You know, one of the things about excavators are, no matter what happens, you keep excavating. Through wars, through terrorism, you go. And Alan Rowe, an excavator, while looking through the Serapeum, found foundation deposits. And interesting foundation deposits. And that's how we know for sure that Ptolemy III built this thing. Because we have foundation deposits, which were plaques. At the corners of the temple were found the pits. And in the pits were 10 plaques. 10. They were made of different material. 5 were glass. Now, glass was an important thing in Alexandria. They manufactured it. Alexandrian glass became famous. Right? They made wonderful little inlays for furniture and things like that. And 5 of the plaques are glass. 1 is mud, clay. 1 is faience, a ceramic. 1 is bronze. 1 is silver. And 1 is gold. Right? Virtually everything you'd build out of or the materials you would use. And on the plaques is an inscription saying, and I'll tell you what it says, King of the South and North, heir of the brother gods, chosen of Amun, powerful in life, Ptolemy III, living forever, beloved of Ptah, he made the temple and sacred enclosure walls of Serapis. So we know from these foundation deposits that Ptolemy III builds this temple. And later, a few years later, other foundation deposits were found inside the temple in a small shrine. Because it was, you're building a little shrine? Dig foundation deposits. And these were for Ptolemy IV. So it shows that Ptolemy IV completed it inside. And there's a very strange thing about these foundation deposits, the ones of Ptolemy IV. They're in code. They say basically the same thing as Ptolemy III's, but they're what we call cryptographic. The Ptolemies got into that, code writing. There are even inscriptions on temple walls that were just in code. It's a simple code, and that's how we can read it. We figured it out. For example, it's like if you used A to represent D, and if you used B to represent E, that kind of thing. That's what they did. Nobody knows why. Maybe the priests are really, you know, hyping it. Hey, this is secret stuff. You know, only we know it. But anyway, Ptolemy III builds the Serapeum, decree of Canopus, Temple of Edfu, good guy, but it's going to go downhill now. This is where we start to get dysfunctional families. And let me tell you why I say this. I mean, it's everybody agrees on this, that these people were really horrible. For example, after Ptolemy III, we get Ptolemy IV, whose other name is Philopater. You know, he's Philopater, lover of his father, right? Loves his father, right? Nice guy, right? He had his mother poisoned. His brother was scalded to death. He died at the age of 41. All the ancient texts say of excess living, right? And his sister wife, Arsinoe, was soon poisoned after his death, right? So you've got three quick murders in this one family. After him, we got Ptolemy V. Now, he takes the throne as a child, right? And we have a document of his that I think you all know, the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone, if you remember, the key to deciphering hieroglyphs, was really a thank you note from the priests of Egypt to Ptolemy V. And what this shows is that the Ptolemies at this time, now remember, he takes the throne as a kid. He's not calling his own shots. Somebody's making a decision for him. He's got advisors. They are trying to placate the priests. The Ptolemies knew you got to keep the priests on your side because they've got the wealth. So this decree says that Ptolemy freed them from having to make certain trips, freed them from taxes, and it's basically a thank you, and we'll put it up in front of the temple saying, what a great guy Ptolemy V is. But that's, in a sense, while it sounds all very nice that he's helping the priests, it's a sign that he's got to placate the priests. He's getting a little bit, you know, weak. Now we have another Ptolemy, Ptolemy VI, fights a civil war with his brother, right? Followed by Ptolemy VII, who's murdered a year after becoming king. And then we get Ptolemy VIII, who lasts a while, right? Now, Ptolemy VIII has, in a sense, two wives. He marries the wife of Ptolemy VI and has a liaison with his niece. And they're both called Cleopatra, so it was really confusing for the people. You know, one was called Cleopatra the sister, and the other was called Cleopatra the wife, right? The sister is Cleopatra II, and Cleopatra the wife is Cleopatra III, right? So they really didn't know what to call him. But he's even shown sometimes with both of his Cleopatras. Now, he had a nickname, right? Physicon. Fatty, right? He was so obese that people called him Fatty, right? They hated him. He was such a rotten guy. They revolted, and he had to flee to Cyprus, right? And his wife, Cleopatra II, is ruling in his absence, and he got annoyed that his wife is ruling in his absence. He was forced to flee. And he has their child, Memphites, right? His son, his own son, dismembered, killed, dismembered, and sends the pieces of his son to his wife as a birthday present, right? Nice guy. He eventually returned to Egypt, right? But he left two children as his heirs, Ptolemy IX and Ptolemy X. He also begins building a temple, right? Strange temple, Komombo. Sometimes I think, you know, Physicon was so bad, this guy, this bad Ptolemy, I mean, dismembering his own child. It is interesting that the temple he builds is dedicated to the crocodile god Sobek. Right? It's called Komombo. It's again in the south. It's an unusual temple, by the way. Many tourists don't realize it, but it's a double temple. It's almost like twin temples conjoined. One is dedicated to a version of Horus, but the other is to Sobek, the crocodile god. And, I mean, this may be my just reading into it, but I get kind of bad vibes from the temple. I'll tell you why. When you go there, there are deep wells, very deep, and often they're viewed as sacred pools. This is where sacred crocodiles were kept. And we have some records that the crocodiles even were bejeweled. They put jewels on these crocodiles, you know, because they were like gods. As you'll see, the Ptolemies are very much into this, these animals. But anyway, he begins Komombo Temple. And eventually Ptolemy IX rules. He starts the temple at Dendera, the Hathor Temple, a very important temple. So they're building temples, at least. He is accused of plotting to kill his own mother, and he flees to Cyprus. So then you get Ptolemy X. And he was so obese, Ptolemy X, that the historians tell us he couldn't walk on his own, that people had to lift him up and hold him up as he walked. Right? Another Ptolemy. Ptolemy XI? Well, it's a sad story. Marries his older aunt, disliked her, right? Disliked her. Murdered her a couple of weeks after the wedding, right? And the people were so incensed that they lynched him, right, after 19 days. Right? Now, what happens is these Ptolemies have almost killed themselves off. They are murdering each other so much that at the end of this Ptolemy's reign, there's virtually no legitimate heir. There's a kind of power vacuum. But we'll see next time that the man who fills the power vacuum is going to be Cleopatra's father. We'll do that next time.